Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Tuesday, the 30th of May, and you're listening to Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko-Kemet.
And Crispin Mwakideo in Bonn, Germany. Stay with us for the stories making headlines across Africa and what you've been saying about them on social media.
In today's edition, the people of Biafra commemorate 50 years since the declaration of an independent Republic of Biafra by declaring a sit-at-home protest.
Life is no longer worth living without Biafra. We've tried Nigeria for, is it 56 years now? Nothing has ever happened. So we want to try something new.
Let Biafra be treated with justice. If Biafrians violate any rule of the nation, let them face the law. That's a comment from Abubakar in Kano. We'll bring you more reactions on this sensitive topic later.
And Kenya is set to launch a multi-billion railway project amid criticism.
As Kenyans, we are very happy about the project, but as a normal citizen, the project will also rob many people of their jobs, especially people like me.
Those stories and a lot more coming up shortly. Stay tuned.
I'm Isaac Mugabe with DW News. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said that she will push hard in Brussels for progress to be made on a free trade agreement between India and the European Union. Merkel was speaking in a speech warning of growing protectionist tendencies worldwide.
Working together with such a diverse country and being there when good developments take place, at the same time as investing and giving German companies a chance, that's of huge importance and in no way directed against any other relationships, and certainly not against the transatlantic ties, which have historically been very important for us and will remain so in the future.
Speaking to journalists after meeting with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Merkel stressed the importance of the relationship with the US, but suggested it was no longer the only game in town. Former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, who spied for the United States before his drug trafficking and brutality triggered a US invasion to oust him in 1989, has died at the age of 83. Noriega, who ruled Panama from 1983 to 1989, was a long-term collaborator of the Central Intelligence Agency and a useful U.S. ally in a region that was prone to leftist insurgencies. But local residents like this one had some kind words spared for Noriega.
I had no ill thoughts about him. He didn't do anything to me. The man simply controlled the country. They had him as a dictator. What can you do? His time to die came. And the time for each of us to die will also come.
Announcing his death, President Juan Carlos Varela said it marked the closing of a chapter in the country's history. Sudan has ratified a ban on the import of Egyptian animal and agricultural products, a development that's certain to deepen months of tensions between the two neighbors over a long-running border dispute. Businessmen in Sudan are now required to import goods directly from the country of origin, known through Egypt, its neighbor to the north. Sudan first banned Egyptian agricultural imports in September, citing health concerns. It later expanded the ban. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir accused Egypt this month of arming rebels fighting against his government in Western Darfur region. Egypt has denied the charge. You are listening to DW News from Bonn, Germany. France's new president Emmanuel Macron has held frank talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Macron left the door open to improving economic ties with Russia, but he also warned his guest that he would not look or overlook human rights abuses in Chechnya or further use of chemical weapons in Syria. 13 South Sudanese soldiers accused of raping 5 foreign aid workers and killing their local colleague appeared before a military court today. The case is seen as a test for the government's ability to try war crimes. The attack, one of the worst on aid workers in South Sudan's war, took place on July 11, 2016, as President Salva Kiir's troops won a three-day battle in Juba over opposition forces loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. UN investigators and rights groups have frequently accused both the army and rebels of murder, torture and rape since the civil war began in 2013 and say the crimes almost always go unpunished. And a massive bombing by the IS group outside a popular ice cream shop in central Baghdad left at least 31 people dead, according to Iraqi officials. For more news, visit our website dw.com/Africa. I'm Isaac Mugabe in Bonn.
You're listening to Africa Link. I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
Now, frustration and hope, that was the mood in southeastern Nigeria, where public institutions today remained closed. It was a response to the sit-at-home directive by the indigenous people of Biafra to commemorate 50 years since the declaration of an independent Republic of Biafra, IPOB, whose repercussions resulted in a civil war that left nearly 2 million people dead. Military helicopters hovered around the home of the IPOB leader, Nnamdi Kanu, as police threatened to clamp down on any breach of peace. Jen Nyingi with this report by Catherine Gensler.
For the better part of the day, schools, markets and other business premises remained closed, with majority of the people opting to stay indoors across major cities in southeast Nigeria. The closures were in honor of those who died during the Biafra Civil War, while others feared an eruption of violence. The southeast region is dominated by Igbo people, one of Nigeria's largest ethnic groups. For years, they felt marginalized, especially in the country's politics. Kingsley Oka, a political science student, says even with the current government of President Muhammadu Buhari, things are not any better.
The kitchen cabinet of the current government, there is no Easterner at all. In other words, if they want to kill the Easterners, the arrangement will go unhindered. And as a people who are educated and lettered, they said, no, we must be able to agitate for our rights. Biafra is the solution.
Such calls have become more popular, especially among the young people. Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra, has been allegedly accused of conspiracy and belonging to a criminal organization. He was released on bail at the end of April, but stresses that fight is still on, and he will do everything to the independence of Biafra.
Life is no longer worth living without Biafra. We've tried Nigeria for, is it 56 years now? Nothing has ever happened. So we want to try something new. The way we were before the British came, we had no wars. We didn't have the need to be afraid to get up in the morning to worship God, because if you do that in Kano, they will behead you.
There are, however, no reliable figures on how many people actually support Biafra. But the whole discussion about independence is clear, says Kingsley Oka, a political science student from southeast Nigeria.
I will not pick up arms to fight. What we need more in Biafra struggle is intellectual fight. You can raise activism through newspaper publication. And some other foot soldiers, some other persons who felt they could help in other, the other way around, engage in street protests without having arms attached to them.
Last year, demonstrations marking the declaration of Biafra independence turned bloody, with Amnesty International saying the military gunned down more than 60 people.
A report by Catherine Gensler. Now, Crispin, I guess that people have already been commenting about this.
Exactly. Now, as we had in that report, Nnamdi Kanu, leader of the indigenous people of Biafra, say they have tried Nigeria for 56 years, but nothing is working. And now it's time to try something else. Well, not all agree with him. Via our WhatsApp service, we got this voice message.
My name is Aremu Izia Kabekuta, Nigeria. I think Biafra is dead. What's just happening is politics. Politics and how would I put, now that Nnamdi Kanu has turned himself into like a lord, praying for people everywhere, then it shows there is no ideology behind it, it's personal. To Biafra, they should just forget about it for now.
And I assume there is a lot more to that, Crispin, isn't it?
Oh, yes, there's this issue is very, very sensitive, and it has been a hard time on the social media desk trying to ensure that we keep the discussion very civilized and not turn to insults or threats.
Yeah.
Let me read this comment from Ekene Anaebo. He says, we need a simple yes or no referendum to determine whether the people of the Southeast, where the people of Southeast belong. The will of the people should be sacrosanct. In feminism, against her will is against the law. And same applies to be upfront.
Okay, we leave it at that for now. Now, here in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel has been holding talks with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The two leaders are pledging to deeper ties on trade and counter-terrorism as India seeks to boost relations with Germany. Here is what the chancellor had to say.
Transatlantic ties are of the utmost importance, regardless of any specific discussions that may be ongoing. But we have long been holding consultations with India, just as we do with China's government. We are a global world. India, with its 1.25 billion citizens, is a partner whose positive development we have a great interest in.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Now, their meeting comes as U.S. President Donald Trump lashed out at Berlin over defense spending and Germany's trade surplus. Trump's criticism came after Merkel seemed to question his reliability as an ally and said Europe should take charge of its destiny. DW's Hans Brandt tells us what this implies.
At the end of the G7 summit last week on the issue of climate change, it was 6-1. It was all of the other G7 members against the United States. And I think now she's trying to build an alliance of countries around the world ahead of the G20 summit, which is happening in Hamburg in mid-July under the auspices of the German government. So she's trying to build an alliance there of countries around the world that will agree on the rules of global trade, the rules of global climate change, of global treaties. I think both China and India may well play an important role against that background.
DW's political correspondent Hans Brandt.
Right, Yeko, let's return to Nigeria, where the so-called Biafrans are marking 50 years since they unilaterally declared independence from the rest of Nigeria.
Yeah.
This comment from G.T. Jerry Agbedun, and he writes, let us think it out. How many countries have survived gaining independence from a country who fought for independence from colonial masters, and how many of them are experiencing peace now? As for me, Nigeria was one, is one, and will remain one, be it by choice or by force.
Interesting comment over there. But we continue in Africa. Now, two sides of the coin. In Kenya, there are mixed reactions on the multi-billion dollar project Standard Gauge Railway. The president is due to launch the first trip between the capital, Nairobi, and the island city of Mombasa. It is the biggest infrastructure project the country has undertaken since independence. DW's Andrew Wasike brings us more on this.
The 460-kilometer standard gauge railway will shorten travel time between the two major cities for both passengers and goods arriving at the port of Mombasa. Despite the project being received with praise, some, especially in the transport sector, feel they will be driven out of business. Juma Hassan, who works as a driver in Mombasa with Coast Express, says that like many others, his job is at stake.
Kwa upande wetu tunafurahia.
As Kenyans, we are very happy about the project, but as a normal citizen, the project will also rob many people of their jobs, especially people like me who are in the business industry. The price we charge will go down due to the competition. The government should regulate the price so that we can also earn a living.
So tunaona ni vizuri rais angalie hiyo.
The cheapest class in the new train will cost a passenger about $5 compared to buses, which charge 3 times that amount. Another concern has been the amount of money used to build the standard gauge railway, which is $3.8 billion. With the opposition under the leadership of former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga calling it a grand corruption scheme by the current leadership. But the chairman of the National Lands Commission, Mohamed Swazuri, dismisses the allegations.
It has been done at reasonable cost. So it's not true that we have overspent, we have stolen some money, we have done this. The people who are bringing these malicious rumors, they timed it to coincide with the launching of this program.
The passenger train has a capacity of 1,260 passengers. At optimal operations, including 118 passengers in each of the economy class coaches, 72 travelers in each of the first class cars, and 34 in the premier business coaches.
Andrew Wasike in Kenya.
Now, Ayeko, as you might be aware, Cameroon is also dealing with a similar issue as Nigeria when it comes to secession.
Yeah.
So some of the Anglophone Cameroonians took this occasion also to air their views. Here is one comment from Julius Otis. He writes, same too with Southern Cameroon, Ambazonia. We have tried La République du Cameroun for 56 years, where we lived as second-class citizens. We want to try something new. Independence.
Yes, confirmation that the story has been attracting lots of comments, really right. So many of them. And I guess that they are still coming, as I can even see on our page. But we shall be reading all of them if we can a little later. You're listening to DW's Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I am Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And co-hosting this show is me, Crispin Mwakideu.
Still to come, why capital flight from Africa is dangerous? We hear from the expert.
A continent that needs money, but it's a continent that also financing the rest of the world.
Tunisia and Kenya have become the latest African countries to ban the use of plastic bags. But will that be enough to deal with the West problem? Stick around for your comments on social media.
Certainly. Now, from political to economic developments, including technological innovation, Africa is undergoing enormous transformation. This, however, does not mean that the continent has or is about to solve its mass of challenges, one of them being capital flight. It is estimated that the continent has lost over $1 trillion as a result of capital flight since the 1970s. Leonce Ndikumana is a professor of economics and director of the Africa Development Policy Program at the University of Massachusetts. He has been speaking to me about the state of capital flight out of Africa and factors accountable for it.
Capital flight is a development issue, and specifically it's a constraint to achieving sustainable development financing for Africa. What we have been highlighting is the paradox where a continent that needs money, but it's a continent that also financing the rest of the world.
The challenge is certainly big, but there've also been lots of strides that are being made, and as you indicate in your publication. My question is then, what has this panel achieved so far?
What the panel has done is go around the continent, illustrate how big the problem is. They have produced reports that show the amount of capital flight that has left the continent by country, and that showing that this problem is not new, that the problem has been there for a long time. But what is even more worrisome is that the volume of capital flight is increasing since the past two decades. As the continent becomes more increases its economic performance, it means that it's becoming a much more attractive investment destination. So money should be flowing into Africa, and money should be staying into Africa instead of going out of the continent.
The G20 has also acknowledged this as a big problem, and it's shown its commitment to combating illicit financial flows. And we do know that this year Germany is certainly holding the presidency of the G20, and they've really put it out clear that their focus is going to be on Africa, as we also see from the Marshall Plan with Africa. There have also been mixed reactions to these plan in particular. And so far, no African president has come out to state their position on this plan. Mm. What is your take on this one?
It is a good initiative. It should be welcomed, and it should be embraced by African countries. The reason I'm saying that is capital flight is an issue that cannot be solved by African countries alone. I think African countries should jump on the bandwagon and join hands with their developed country partners to find solutions for capital flight. For African countries to make any progress in stopping capital flight, they need the cooperation of developed countries to close the door to this illicit money coming to their own countries.
Well, as we are talking about capital flight from Africa, there seems to be a newfound love for this, or what I would rather call the scramble for Africa, where we see, like you just explained, foreign investments going to Africa. What could explain these factors?
In the case of FDI, this is private investment seeking profit, and they see profit in Africa, they'll go find it. The bulk of the capital that's fleeing out of Africa is illicit, illegally acquired, smuggled out of the continent. So it is not motivated by returns to investment. The owners, having acquired that money illicitly, are not looking for maximizing profit. They must be looking for maximizing security of their assets away from the eyes of the legal authority.
I was speaking to Leonce Ndikumana of the Africa Development Policy Program at the University of Massachusetts.
Africa on the move.
From a street beggar to an entrepreneur and a moneylender, that's the story of Masu Chikuse. Having been ridiculed for begging, Chikuse realized begging would not take him anywhere. Starting off as a mobile photographer and to hawking, the 40-year-old amputee today uses his own experience to encourage others not to look down upon themselves. Miriam Kaliza reports.
Masu Chikuse is a force to reckon with in Malawi. Despite being disabled and coming from a poor background, he's been able to start up projects that have helped his community. Born in 1977, Chikuse initially thought he couldn't do anything by himself. He therefore relied on other people for physically and material help. His lowest point in life was in 2003, when he had no option but to beg on the streets so as to provide for his wife and children. After being ridiculed for a while because of begging, the father of two decided to put that to a stop. He says embarrassment was not worth whatever he was getting from begging, and he had to man up. Chikuse says from his begging savings, he managed to buy a digital camera.
I used to beg in front of Asian shops, since I could not take care of myself financially. Due to my disability, I could not do any other activity that could generate money for me. However, begging still could not sustain my family, and I decided to find something better to do with myself. From my savings, I bought a digital camera so I could take photographs of people.
Unfortunately, the photography business wasn't as yielding as he thought, because at times the photos he had taken remained uncollected. He decided to change his business and become a hawker. It is at this point that he was introduced to Mpita Concept Cooperative, a saving and investment society. He immediately joined the cooperative.
I started buying shares and taking out loans to boost my business. Now you can see I am a different person altogether. I have constructed a modern house for my family and my mother. I bought a plot in town at Biwi area. I am able to do things for my family I only dreamt of doing. My life has completely changed, and I will never dream of needing to beg again.
Currently, he is an Airtel money agent in his village, owns a shop, and also loans out money to people. Rosina Tafatata is a member of the Cooperative Society Union. She says many of them have managed to build decent houses and also pay school fees for their children through the support of the Cooperative Society.
Our members are better off on their own. Most of them are financially sound, and they are able to care for their children and household. Just like Chikuse, many have put up modern houses for themselves, including me.
Apart from the wealth he has accumulated over the years, Chikuse, whose current net value hovers around $8,000, says he's diversifying his enterprise by venturing into livestock business.
Miriam Kalezi reporting.
Focus Europe.
Now, Crispin, have you ever heard of the saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get going?
I have indeed.
Okay, well, overwhelmed by the hundreds of refugees and limited accommodation, the city of Berlin has come up with another housing strategy, container housing. As Lovely Wright reports, the sports halls that used to house them have now been handed over back to the sports club as the refugees settle down in their new container village.
At first glance, this container village in the east of Berlin looks bleak. White shipping containers are lined up on scrubby grass, separated by grey gravel paths. They're surrounded by a high fence, and a security guard is ready to check IDs at the entrance. A couple of boys are kicking a football around, while girls are playing with dolls in the sandy dirt. It's only later, when people return from their German classes, from school or from work, that the sparse container camp feels more like a home to a community, albeit a makeshift one. 250 refugees live here, mainly from Syria, Iraq, Iran and Afghanistan. Alan Chaiko, preparing black tea in his tiny kitchen, is one of them. He shares his container home with three other Syrians. Before moving here in January, they lived in a sports hall for more than a year.
This is my Zimmer. This is my bed.
This is my room, a cupboard, a desk. This is my bathroom.
Alan has the top bunk. It's two to a room, and each home is made up of two container bedrooms connected by a narrower strip for the kitchen and bathroom. The refugees could have to stay here for up to 3 years, while the city struggles to find them longer-term accommodation.
When we first moved here, I felt a bit shy. I didn't feel comfortable here. But when I got to know the people working here, they were so nice and helped us a lot. Like when we received letters, they explained everything. I've got used to living here now, but it's a bit far from the city center. I can't live here for 3 years.
Finding a flat in Berlin is difficult. The city is going through a housing crisis at a time when more and more people are moving here. Sascha Langenbach from Berlin's State Office for Refugee Affairs admits the containers aren't ideal, but he says they're a huge improvement.
Some people who were living in the sports halls didn't even have the independence to use a light switch for a year. Here, at least, they're able to close the door behind them and, for example, do their German homework. That's extremely difficult if you're living in a sports hall with 200 others. Yes, of course, people were probably hoping for something better, but we don't have that at the moment. For now, this is a step in the right direction.
22 container villages are planned for the city, and the biggest one yet is still under construction at Berlin's old Tempelhof Airport. Built by the Nazis, this airport became the site of the famous Berlin airlift during the Cold War. In 2014, 6 years after it closed, Berlin has voted in a referendum to keep the airfield as a park and against developing it for housing. That's one of the reasons why the container village here is especially controversial. It might be just a short-term solution, but it's set to cost the city 17 million euros over the next 2.5 years.
Lefty Right reporting. Now, Crispin, let's revisit what people have been talking about on social media.
Right, Ayeko. And it's a very interesting topic. We posted an article on our Facebook page about the fact that Kenya and Tunisia now have banned the use of plastic bags, and they join several other African countries who have done that. Now, get this. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, more than 8 million tons of plastic end up in the oceans every year.
Such an amount.
Every year, can you imagine? Mm-hmm. Where it impacts marine life, fisheries and tourism. Now, the sad part of it is that environmentalists argue that the plastic is not biodegradable, meaning it doesn't break down completely, and there's a risk that humans could still end up ingesting small pellets through fish and water.
That's such a danger, isn't it? And I can also see another comment. What I would like to say is that we have to be honest with this topic. And why is this happening, and why is this happening in Africa?
Exactly. The question is why many people in Africa do not feel any guilt when they throw away plastics in the streets? I think that's... Jen, have you ever done that? You're from Uganda. Have you done that?
Actually, what I've done is to tell people to pick up their rubbish when they throw it.
They throw it away.
And they look at me like, what the hell are you telling me to do here?
I'm personally guilty. I've probably done, not plastic, but banana peelings or peanuts. You
that's
know, when you eat peanuts.
That's a little bit degradable other than plastic bags.
Exactly. Anyway, science aside, Abdul Atif Ola says... Let's turn waste management into business that profits the masses, then watch the streets become cleaner.
Yes, and Isaac Godwin says, it's a welcome move that will keep our cities clean. Here in Monrovia, plastic bags were banned last year. Some good move there from Monrovia.
Exactly. We have another comment from Bonnie Njenga, who writes from Kenya and says, it's how many people have been socialized from a young age. We just lack collective responsibility. And I kind of tend to agree with this, that many people don't have that collective responsibility. You know, we are brought up to believe that, okay, I mean, throwing garbage, it's just fine, or throwing dirty water, it's fine. But here in Germany, as you can tell, there are bins everywhere. People from a very early stage are taught that you have to dispose waste in the right places. You have BO for green,
green
dust and all the rest, plastic and
Before we even get into the separating rubbish as it is here, Crispin, do you think this is something that is inbuilt? I think it's not too late for us to teach our people.
No, not at all. I think it is just a question of governments, civic society organizations coming up and training people and teaching them from an early age to be responsible. And it's just a matter of time. I think it worked here and it can work anywhere.
I think there is also some hope. The last time I was in my hometown, I saw some bit of progress there. I even saw they had put up bins and cans in the cities and
there is hope.
Anyway. Yes, there is.
Okay, there's a comment here before we go. Paul Abraham says, the city councils do not exist. And I think this is also another problem, that city councils basically are not functioning, the institutions to take care of the waste.
Yeah, but like I just said, there is hope. We are getting there slowly.
Absolutely.
That's all we had for you. Thank you for listening to Africa Link. I'm Jane Ayeka-Kumet.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
We shall be here tomorrow. Bye-bye.